Here we go.
Any questions? Anything? Everybody having... anyone who's trying the Bayesian stuff, have you had an easy time getting your files into the, if you're for like Mr. Bayes, you need to be in Nexus format, everybody having an easy time with that? Somebody, well, didn't, but, okay. I don't know why the people who designed the Nexus format gave it a name that not only is the same name as a format for like X-ray astronomy files, and also the name of a line of shampoos. That was really not a smart decision. Okay. So we're into bootstraps, and I told you the general rationale, which is for distributions in general, when you don't know the underlying distribution, you take the empirical distribution of your sample and create fake data sets by sampling from that histogram. And because it's sampling from that histogram, it's sampling with replacement, because the histogram doesn't change each time you sample. And then you get a collection of bootstrap replicate data sets as large as you can afford, and you make your estimate from each of them, and that gives you a good idea of how much uncertainty there is in that estimate. And we're then applying it to phylogenies. And in phylogeny case, the rationale is also that the thing we're estimating is a very complex and sort of unclear function of the data. So that's another reason that we would use the bootstrap, is not just that we don't know the underlying distribution, but we don't know the path from the underlying distribution to the estimate we're making. Okay, so you get a cloud of trees. So you do this, suppose you did 1,000 bootstrap samples, you get 1,000 trees. In a sense, that's the answer. I mean, there you have it, the cloud of trees. That's the kind of variability. Then the only question is, how do we summarize that in a sensible way? And here you get into the issue of there are many possible ways of doing it, not all of which have been explored by any means. There's room for more different ways of extracting information from that cloud of trees. The cloud of trees is a pretty good representation of your uncertainty. The particular statistics that you may extract from it, I have the problem. Excuse me, I'm sneezing, but this time it's allergy, so you don't have to move away. It's tree allergy. Excuse me. Okay. So the way of summarizing this variability that has been most widely used is to look at the partitions of the tip species that are induced by branches in the tree. Each branch makes a partition of the tips. Now, I have to sort of ask you about that. We're going to be going through this example. When I have a particular branch here, and it makes a partition, why am I not saying that what we're seeing is the presence or absence of one clade? Why am I not saying it that way? Yeah?
Does that clade still exist in another, not in this example?
I'm having trouble hearing you. My hearing isn't that good.
The clade still exists, right? But so the partition actually establishes like two different.
Well, let's look at this case here. There's these two BD and these four. Which is the clade? Maybe and maybe not. Suppose the root was here. Is EACF a clade? And the answer is no, it's not. if in one of those sets of branches, if the root happened to be right in this branch, both would be clades. If the root were in one set or the other, in one set of branches or the other, then one of them isn't a clade and the other is. But what they are in an unrooted tree is a partition. So each branch corresponds to a partition. The two sets of the two sets in the partition, at least one of them is a clade, maybe both, but you don't know which. So the easy way of, for unrooted trees, the easy way is to say that what we're talking about here is a partition. For rooted trees, if you had a method like UPGMA, which you can use in a bootstrap analysis, it defines a rooted tree, and then the things you see when you look at a branch, it tells you that one particular set is a partition. I'm sorry, is a clade, and that's okay. All right, so that's just a little bit of a matter of terminology, but you're doing the same thing either way. So here's a set of five trees. We're imagining that they came up, that this is the cloud of trees you had in a bootstrap analysis. So you did 1,000 replicates, and each time you got an estimated tree, here are the first five of them. Obviously, I'm not going to give you an example with 1,000. So let's see how we analyze them. Well, what you do is you take each interior branch in the tree, and you get the partition for it. So for this branch, it's this one here. These are some of the others that are going to appear. Now, why am I not using the exterior branches, the branches that lead directly to a tip? Can anybody give me a good reason for that?
Yeah, there are always a partition there. I mean, if you just say, no matter which tree you look at, it's always going to be the same.
Yeah, E is always going to be at the end of its own branch. There may be some trees in which E isn't at the end of its own branch, but it's in an interior node, so that would be an exception. But even there, then there isn't any interest in looking at that branch. So this branch is always there, and there's just no point. I mean, it's there 100% of the time. Let's not bother with it. We can always assume it's there. Same for any other set. And now let's continue. I'll show you it for the three interior branches of this tree. This branch here defines that set. So what we're going to do is just make a list and put a number next to each one as to how many times it shows up. This one over here is the third and last of the interior branches. It's EA versus everybody else. There it is. So these guys showed up on the first tree. Now we go to the second tree. I'm not showing you the three steps, but there are three interior branches, and they create this new one, AC versus everybody else. There it is. DF versus everybody else, there it is. And we find on the center, we find ACE versus BDF, which we also found on this tree. So we take that one and just turn it into a 2. So you're building up a list of partitions, and if they occur more than once, you just put the number next to them. And you keep doing this. So, sorry, there is the next tree. Here are more partitions. The purple ones are the new ones that have showed up. The fourth tree gets you more. Actually gets you more of the same ones that you already have. And finally, the fifth tree. So here's the complete list. And we have five trees. And that's where the issue comes up. Okay, you've got this list. What can you do with it? How can you inform people about the frequently occurring partitions? And here there's a wonderful method invented in 1981 by Margush and McMorris. Buck McMorris is a mathematician, and he was at, I think, Bowling Green State University in Ohio or Kentucky, whichever state that's in. And he's an expert in, like, voting systems. So he told me a story that he was department chair, and they needed to choose a committee. And he suggested a voting system to them. And everybody voted, and they came up with a committee. And then somebody said, well, I don't think that was a good voting system. Could we try another? So they all agreed, okay, we'll vote again.
And McMorris suggested another voting system, and they voted, and they got a completely different committee. And he did this like a third time, and by that time everybody in the department wanted to kill him. Because it turns out there really is, if you ask mathematicians who work on voting systems, there is no perfect voting system. You will often see, there are all kinds of theorems showing that, although they can show that some voting systems are definitely bad ones, there is no perfect one. You will often hear people say that there is this great voting system where everybody votes, everybody ranks people in preferences and assigns weights and does this and does that. They're often very complicated. And they say, that's the best voting system. They're wrong. There is all kinds of mathematical work. This was a way of voting among trees. Margush and McMorris made something called majority rule consensus trees. And we're going to see that that involves this thing we talked about in when we talked about compatibility methods. The pairwise compatibility theorem comes in here because Margush and McMorris says, take the list of, in this case, partitions. Pick the one, all the ones that are present a majority of the time. That is, not exact, more than exactly half the time. If you take those, they claimed, and put them together, you can get them all onto the same tree. They will all fit on a tree. Why is that? Well, because we just have to say if two partitions fit on the same tree, then they are compatible. Well, think about it. We had 0-1 characters, and we were looking at compatibility. The definition of compatibility was whether the 0-1 characters would fit on the same tree. Here you just take these species, assign them a 0, and these species assign them a 1 in an imaginary character. And these ones assign zeros and assign ones in another character. Those two characters will be compatible if and only if the two partitions will fit on the same tree. And if two partitions are present more than 50% of the time, then there must be one of these trees on which they both are present, and therefore they are compatible. It's just like saying, it's the same logic, if more than half of you have a penny in your pocket, and more than half of you have a nickel in your pocket, there's got to be somebody who has both a penny and a nickel in their pocket. So majority rule consensus trees just work using the compatibility theorems. And what they show is, there is a tree. Wait, here is the list, again, without any coloration. And there's the tree. So all you have to do is take the list of things that are present more than half the time. It's just like compatibility. You use tree popping. You make the tree from those partitions, which is just a very direct thing to do. There it is. I deliberately chose a case where this tree is not equal to any of those trees. It's not the same tree. It has interior branches. There is no single tree that has all those. They are each present 3/5 of the time, and the convention has become to put a number next to the branch, a 2-digit, or up to if it's 100%, a 3-digit number, indicating what fraction of the time that partition was present in the bootstrap trees. So there is the majority rule consensus tree, and it is a good quick summary of the frequently occurring clades that are well supported by the bootstrap. So now, again, I want to emphasize, this isn't inevitably the only way you can analyze a cloud of bootstrap trees. There might be better ways out there, but this is certainly the most popular because kind of whether a particular clade is present is often the focus of people's studies. So let's look. This is just the logic that I just told you about. You construct a fake character for each partition, and then you have this compatibility argument that I gave that if two occur more than 50% of the trees, then they co-occur in at least one tree, so they must be compatible. And by the pairwise compatibility theorem, all the sets that occur more than 50% of the time, they're all pairwise compatible, and therefore they're jointly compatible. And you get that means there is a tree that has them all. And here is an analysis. I believe this was a parsimony analysis, but I have to go back and check at some point. Of our 14 species DNA, mitochondrial DNA data set, with 100 replicates. 100 is a little on the small side these days. When Bootstrap started to be used, it was when computation had gotten to the point where it could just barely be done, and 100 replicates was often all you had the time for. Now people can do 1,000 or 10,000 replicates. What you see here is, although this is a rooted tree, it's really an unrooted tree. Chimp and human are present 84% of the time. Chimp, human, gorilla is present 80% of the time, 84% of the time. Chimp, human, gorilla, orang, this little branch here, is present 72% of the time. All the apes are present 74% of the time. In the rhesus Japanese crab-eating and Barbary macaques, they're present 100% of the time, and these two groups are 99 out of 100 replicates. Some less supported groups, like tarsier and lemur, is really not completely correct. It's present 49% of the time. It's actually not a true group from what we know from other molecular sequences with these data. Likewise, having the mouse more related to the monkeys and apes than it is to tarsier and lemur is wrong, but that's only present 35% of the time. Now, there's something wrong here. Is this a majority rule consensus tree? Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask about the 49, 42, since they're less than...
They're less than 50%. What am I doing? What I'm doing, actually, is putting on all the more than 50% groups. Okay, but then I would have some lack of resolution in the rest of the tree. Now, maybe that's worth just having it be that way. But if I want to get a fully resolved tree, what I do is I go down the list of partitions, picking the most we sort them in order of how frequently they occur, picking the most frequently occurring ones that I come to, and keeping them if they are compatible with the ones that we already have on the tree, which they need not be. When you get down below 50%, they need not be compatible. So these are some frequent partitions that aren't quite majority rule, but I put them on just to get some resolution there. Okay, so there is a majority rule, what I call an extended majority rule consensus tree, just to make the distinction. It's doing a reasonable job of showing that there's very strong support for these macaques being together, pretty strong support in the apes. Good support, not quite as high. For the old world monkeys plus apes, that is a true group. Here's the only new world monkey. And not very good support for the structure outside of that in this parsimony analysis of this small data set. Yeah.
So for the ones that you're trying to resolve, do you try to maximize that value in some ways?
Like maximize which value?
What I mean is like the 49, 42. I'm guessing if you had picked a different partition, would those values be lower?
Well, I can go further down the list. What I do is I pick the ones that are highest up. Now, if I have some that are tied, it becomes an arbitrary choice. Mm-hmm. If they happen both to be compatible, then I would be making an arbitrary choice. One shouldn't do a lot of worrying about whether this support here is really stronger than that support there. You're too far down. Now, there is the issue of, well, is this something like a p-value? Can you reject groups if they're less than 95%? And the answer is really no. As I'll show you in a moment, Bootstrap p-values, which would be 1 minus these fractions, are biased. These values are biased downwards. They should be higher, but there's a bias built into the bootstrap. Yeah.
Do you ever see internal nodes that are below, that appear in a tree that are below 50%?
Here are some.
Bracketed by higher confidence.
Yeah, you could.
Okay.
You can very well have two very well supported groups, and there's a third group in between them, and maybe it's more closely related to one, or maybe more closely related to the other, but the branches are short, not too many characters changed in there, the support isn't very strong to say whether it's this way or that way. That's quite easy to happen. Other bootstrappy questions would be welcome at this point. Well, there's a lot of additional things to say. Here are some problems with the bootstrap. One is, we have assumed in the whole theory here that the sites are evolving independently, all in the same tree, but independently otherwise. If that's not true, then we are possibly overestimating our support. Good example would be ribosomal RNA, where there are sites that are paired to maintain a stem loop structure. When one of those changes, there's a lot of natural selection pressure to change the other one. So you have two sites that tend to change in a concerted way, which means that when you look at those two sites, it's not independent evidence. And so you're overestimating how many sites you really have. Somebody may say, well, the other thing we're saying is we're assuming that the sites come from a common distribution. But maybe some sites are changing faster and some sites are changing slower. Isn't that a problem? And what I have to say there is, well, it wouldn't be a problem if we can make one more additional assumption. If we can say, well, some sites change faster, some sites change slower, so there's a distribution of fast-changing sites, a distribution of slow-changing sites. But if this assignment of fast and slow is itself independent from site to site, then what we can say is we got a mixture distribution. And so for any site, we just pick which mode, whether the fast or slow is the distribution we're drawing from and draw from that. That whole thing is its own, is a distribution. If the assignment of fastness and slowness is independent from site to site, then you're still picking from one distribution. So it's actually not necessarily a problem. Now, there's a serious, serious problem here, a multiple test problem. And that comes up, let me just look back at the previous. You're doing a study, you've got a molecule, you got trees, you did a bootstrap, but you're not sure what question you're asking. You're saying, I'm going to write a paper. I want to write a paper on something that supported dramatically here. Let's see what it is. Well, human chimp is, it's supported, but, oh, wait a second, the macaques, let's write a macaque paper. Okay. So what you're doing is you have a whole bunch of questions you could ask, and you picked your question after the fact based on how much support it had. Now, anybody who does t-tests or something knows that if you test a lot of independent tests, 1 out of 20 of them is going to be in the top 5%, even if there's no signal there at all. And so when you do multiple tests, you really have to correct for that. If you don't correct for that, you're in trouble. And so going fishing, p-value fishing, is not a good idea. And people tend to do it. They tend to say, oh, this data set didn't say anything sensible about the apes. Oh, let's wait, it says something about the fish. Let's publish a fish paper. Oh, not a good idea. So multiple tests is an issue. The p-values are biased. I'll give you a little of a hint of that in a moment. The other thing to say is the bootstrapping does not correct for biases in phylogeny methods. So if you have parsimony methods that are having a long branch attraction problem, you're not going to get rid of it by doing bootstrapping. All it will do is confirm that this group shows up repeatedly, but it may be showing up repeatedly because of long branch attraction. There's no magical property of bootstraps to correct biases in the method. So, for example, if you have great differences of rates of evolution, but you forget that and apply UPGMA, which is assuming a clock, you'll get a distorted rooting of the tree, and bootstrap won't in any way correct that. Okay, there are other resampling methods.
There's one called the delete half jackknife, which is like bootstraps in the way it's done and the way it's analyzed, except the sampling. Instead of pulling 150 sites or 1,000 sites out of 1,000 with replacement so that you get some sites more than once and some sites not at all, you sample a random half of the sites. So you take, for example, you could sort the data, put the sites in a random order, and just take the first half of them. That's another sampling method. In fact, when you go over the theory of it, it has the same essentially, well, there's a few minor quibbles here, but it essentially behaves the same as bootstrap. So there are people out there who, for reasons that I think are not sensible, think that the one is much more important, that bootstrap is horrible because it overemphasizes some characters and drops others, but somehow jackknife is great, that one is philosophically justified and the other isn't. I don't think there's much of a difference in application, and there's not that much difference in justification. So it's another way. There's also been advocated a delete one over the constant E jackknife that had a rationale that I mostly reject. It's too little deletion. It tends to result in trees that are too similar. They don't vary enough. People then say, oh, it gives stronger support to the groups. That shows it's a better method. No, it doesn't. It shows it's giving too much support. And in fact, if you reweight the characters by putting numerical weights on them, drawn from an exponential distribution, you get another resampling method that, again, is just about as good as delete half jackknife and just about as good as bootstrap. In fact, reweighting them by any set of exchangeable weights that have a coefficient of variation of 1 has the same justification. Now, there is another method called, there are two other methods that are of interest. I'm going to come back to parametric bootstrap in a moment. Let me just say that people might wonder, well, what do you do if the sites aren't independent, but there's some kind of autocorrelation that their rates, let's say, are similar along the molecule in a non-random way. And there is a Swiss statistician, Hans Kunsch, in 1989, came up with another method, which is block bootstrapping. So you take some number, you say, well, they're correlated maybe in runs of about 3, so let's take a number that's a little bit bigger than that, let's say 4. We're going to choose blocks of 4 adjacent sites at a time. And we're going to choose, if it's 1,000 sites, we'll choose 250 of those blocks, so we end up with 1,000 sites. So you're sampling random blocks of a certain length in hopes that those blocks kind of contain all the correlated sites, mostly. So this is a legitimate way of coping. Even if they aren't correlated, it's supposed to give you approximately the right answer. Yeah.
So can blocks overlap in block bootstrap?
They can. Okay. You start at a random point and you go to the next 4. The interesting question, what if you start close to the end? Usually people just wrap around to the beginning. Rather than have a block that isn't big enough. There's no real correlation between that end and the beginning, but it's just to get a block of the right size. Okay, that's an interesting method. Then there's parametric bootstrap. And let me try to explain. Oh, here is, by the way, the parsimony analysis of the same data with the delete half jackknife. Let's look and see how it is. Well, in the apes, the probabilities are, again, 80 and 84. This is a little different, and that's a little different. They're not hugely different. And remember, the presence or absence of each of these sites, of each of these groups, it's a random thing from one bootstrap replicate to another. So it's like tossing coins. If I said, well, I see 72%, support here, but if I go back and look at the other one, it's 74. Isn't that important? Well, if you were tossing coins and you got 72 heads on one run of 100 heads, 100, and one run of 100 tosses, you got 72 heads. The next time you tossed, you got 74 heads. Would you say that those coins are different in their heads probability?
No, not with that number of tosses. So you have to think of these as the number of heads in the appropriate number of tosses in order to interpret how different these probabilities might be. They're basically not different here. This is a little bit higher. I think this was 77 in the other tree. It's 80 here. They're basically giving you the same signal. The one thing that was different is here the cow and mouse are correctly off elsewhere. The root is probably on the... It's actually probably on the cow branch because in the tree of mammals, rodents are a little more closely related to us. So the root's probably up there, but the unrooted structure is about right. Now, however, it only has 32% support, so it's really weakly supported. Tarsier and lemur are incorrect. Tarsier is really supposed to be branching off of this branch, and it's not. And that's 59% support, so it's greater than 50, but it's not very high. Okay. So there's delete half jackknife. One can do, this is talked through in the book, and you might go look at it. I imagined a case in which you have N1 characters supporting one tree and N2 supporting one resolution of a tree, N2 supporting another, and then we sample from them in the two different ways, in the bootstrap way and in the leaf half and 1 over E jackknife. And basically what you can see is that if you define matching as either M1 being greater, if M1 is, it has stronger support whenever it's more frequently present and half the time when it's tied, the numbers between bootstrap and the lead half jackknife come out pretty close in a numerical example that I showed. If you want to see the details, go look it up in the book. I'm not going to talk you through it. It's with 100 characters, 10 of which support the first resolution, 8 of which support the second. Bootstrap tells you there's 68% support. Delete F jackknife tells you 7.55. Close enough. Okay. John Harshman, very good molecular systematist, did a paper in 1994 arguing, some people had said for parsimony analysis it was common for people to drop characters that didn't vary. Then other people said, that's going to bias the bootstrap. He has a paper showing you that it doesn't. Because although you are drawing now from only the parsimony, the characters informative to a parsimony method, you're drawing a fewer set of times. And it turns out that that works out. I'm not going to go through the details there. I want to get a little bit to the bias in bootstraps and then a little bit to the non-parametric bootstrap, which is an important one. And then maybe we'll get to the material we're supposed to lecture on for today for falling behind. This is in a toy example where instead of trees, we have normal distributions on a scale. And we imagine that there is a normal distribution with a true mean, and we imagine that we are summarizing not the values on the scale, but we're going to draw a sample, take the mean. If the mean is greater than zero, we're going to say we're in topology one. If the mean is less than zero, we're going to say we're in topology two. Now, if this is the true distribution right here, so the mean is right there, we are supposed to, the topology one is where the distribution really is, but a certain fraction of the time, characters will come up as supporting topology two. That's in this bold-faced, in this thick line distribution, it's this chunk of the tail that sticks out past zero. So that is, in a sense, the correct tail probability value. Now, let's see. In practice, any sample you draw, which you're then going to draw a sample, you're going to take its mean, and to do bootstrapping, you're going to sample from a distribution with that mean. Not with the true mean, which you of course don't know, but with the mean, the empirical mean. we're going to assume here that we somehow know that all the distributions have variance 1. They all have the same variance, so I don't have to deal with another aspect of the distribution. Well, some of the time, the sample we draw will have a larger numerical value, a larger empirical mean, and some of the time, a smaller empirical mean. So that's like saying we got characters that supported the correct tree more strongly, or sometimes we get fewer of them and they support it less strongly. In this case, it's obviously equally likely that you'll go in either of those two directions. And when you do, though, the percentage of the distribution that sticks out past zero varies. If you go to the right, it's just this little bit here. P-value goes down a lot. The p-value that you get is the see if I shaded this wrong. Let me see. It's how often you get support for topology 1. And when you go to the right, you get a lot more support for topology 1. When you go to the left, you get a lot less. You get a much bigger tail sticking into the wrong region. And it's nonlinear. You can just see from the shapes of the normal distribution that the p-value here increases, but it turns out it increases less than the p-value on this side decreases. And if I show you that, it looks like this. Here's the true p-value, which is not, you don't know, because you can't see where the true distribution is. Because if you could see where the true distribution is, there's no point of this whole study. You know the answer. You know that you're in topology 1. The data will sometimes support your tree too strongly and sometimes less strongly. Looking at these areas, we plot them, and what we'll see is the integral of a normal distribution, and as it gets up here, it goes up less, and as it goes down this way, it goes down more. The average of those is lower. So the average p-value you get out of support for the well-supported tree is low. And there is I won't go through all the details here, but this is using that toy normal distribution case. You can show here that here's the true p, here's the average p you get out, and it follows this curve. And that says that when you get large p-values, up near 95%, you really get much lower p's than you really should get. So the high p-values in this toy normal case are not high enough in the bootstrap. And it's because the p-value things depend non-linearly on the data. So you can expect that high p-values that are like 85% might actually be significant, even though they don't make it up to 95%. A common method is for people to sort of trust anything over 70%. You can argue sometimes that's justified and sometimes not. Okay, and this is more using a whole Bayesian scheme. Anyway, I'm going to skip this one and talk about the parametric bootstrap. So bootstrap significance values are bootstrap support values are not as high as they should be when they're high. How about other methods like the bootstrap? The when you describe the bootstrap, it's actually formally called the non-parametric bootstrap. This is a method called the parametric bootstrap, also invented by Bradley Effern in 1985. And what he said is, okay, instead of resampling from your data set, let's do something else. Let's say, well, we think we know the distribution from which things came. We're a little more willing to trust it. Let's say we think we know it came from the distribution you would use if you were computer simulating the evolution of the DNA. If so,
what you can do is say, well, let's take our original data. We don't know the true tree. If we knew the true tree, that would be the answer. We wouldn't need any of this. So what we can do is get an estimate of the tree. So that triangle, upside down triangle, is the tree. So make an estimate. And we'll say, well, just like our distribution of data points is approximately an estimate of the true underlying distribution, this tree is approximately an estimate of the true tree. Let us take this tree and simulate data sets of this size on it. So if the data set is 800 nucleotides long, we'll say, okay, take the true tree, take our model, and take this as an estimate of the true tree, and simulate 800 nucleotide data set, 800 nucleotide alignments on it. So you do that. You simulate and get a data set. There it is. It's not resampled from the original data. It's simulated on the estimate of the tree. The hope is the estimate of the tree is somewhere near the true tree, and thus the noise in it should be about right. It would only be perfectly right if we totally believe our model and we totally believe this tree, which is not quite true. So you take this fake data set, and then you say, here's the tree. Apply your estimation procedure, whatever it is. Here's the tree. Do it again. Simulate data. Get a tree. Simulate data. Get a tree. Keep doing it 100 times or 1,000 times or whatever you can afford. So there you again have a cloud of trees. How do you analyze them? The same way. Majority rule consensus tree is a good one. So it's another resampling method. It's one that's a little bit more relying on the model. If you sample out of the original data either by bootstrap or jackknife, you're taking whatever the distribution turned out to be, so that if there are departures from your model, you are showing the noise that would result from that. Here, if you're trusting the model and you're not exploring much, you're not exploring at all what error there might be in the model. So you can argue that bootstrap and jackknife are more robust. That this is a less robust, but it's a way you can do it if you're pretty sure of the model. The surer you are that the model is somewhere near the truth, the more credibility parametric bootstrap will have. So what do? If we do parametric bootstrap on our primates data, here we go. And what we get are groups shown on, these are probably parsimony. And what you get is stronger support in the apes. Not as strong support, but pretty good. 98% and 98%, only this one's 82% in the macaques. Still showing strong support in the macaques. Not quite as strong as the non-parametric bootstrap. Strong support for old world monkeys and apes being together. The mouse sneaked in here. There are the two kinds of trees, one where the mouse sneaks in where it shouldn't be. The mouse is behaving too much like a human. That I call the Walt Disney tree. The other is where a cow is behaving too much like human, and that's the Gary Larson tree. I see you still know who Gary Larson is. He came up in the 80s, of course, lives around here somewhere, and for about 10 years he did thousands of cartoons, and they're all still around, making him huge amounts of money. One of my students, in his first year of doing cartoons, of Gary Larson's first year of doing cartoons, many of which were about biology, invited him to a genetics department student potluck and invited me along. And I stupidly said, oh, well, I'm a faculty member. I really shouldn't intimidate people by showing up. Missed my chance to meet Gary Larson, who did come, and who, after he had dealt with my students, said that he had never before met one of his characters. The student was very, whose name I will not give, put it in his thesis in his little autobiography part. He was very proud of having been declared by Gary Larson to be a Gary Larson character. That's when the cow sneaks in. That's a Gary Larson tree. This is a Walt Disney tree. It's showing support for this bizarre group, but not huge amounts. Likewise, the wrong lemur tarsier group is showing some support here. So it's sort of like the others. It's a little different, and it shows a little bit more support for some things and less support for others. But it's ballparky okay. Jackknife and bootstrap are usually closer to each other than this. Excuse me, this was supposed to be a piece of ice for my eye, but my eye is itching. Okay. I thought I saw some hands fluttering up. I think you got your hand up first.
You might have mentioned this, but when you simulate the data on the tree, do you try to preserve like the rates?
You preserve every aspect of the model that you used. Like if it's a likelihood model, you have a model in likelihood. You simulate under that model.
I mean, not the model, but let's say in your data set you had a certain distribution, different rates.
Yeah, you estimate all the parameters of the model.
I see. Okay.
And that would estimate. Well, for example, if it was independent from site to site, but had a drew from a gamma distribution, you'd estimate the parameter of that. When you simulated, you would draw from that distribution of rates, and then have each site have a rate which is a draw from that distribution. It wouldn't necessarily associate the same estimated rates, because those estimated rates estimate. This is a technical minutiae. Those rates estimated for each site aren't parameters. The estimate of the gamma distribution. Parameters is a parameter, so technically you don't do it that way, but you do draw from the distribution of rates. There were two other people who had their hands up. You're one.
So in the previous slides, or in the previous biology, Barbary macaque was like outgrouped to all the other macaques.
Was that true?
I hope so. Is it possible to get really good support for inconsistencies between these methods like this?
Let's see. Barbary macaque was strongly supported outgroup, and if I go back to the other tree, yep, in the parsimony analysis anyway.
And then it's strongly supported differently here.
Yeah, that's troublesome, isn't it? It's strongly supported, except it's this 82% that's the branch that causes the trouble. Barbary macaque is in here, so this 98% branch. Yeah, that's an interesting example. A, it can happen. You just saw it happen. B, it shouldn't happen, but there's no law. There's no law that says it won't. Somebody else had their hand up on some other bootstrappy point. Okay, so we're really at the end here with the. I'll just finish up by saying. So we're now like one lecture behind, which gets to be a problem this late in the course. When you do things like, do you remember likelihood ratio tests? Another way of doing them in a sampling way related to the parametric bootstrap is to say you do the likelihood ratio test, doubling the difference in log likelihoods between, say, no clock and a clock. But when you go to look it up on what it asymptotically is supposed to be a chi-square distribution, you might say, I'm not sure it really has that distribution. There is a way that people have put forward of using parametric bootstrap to simulate data sets on your best estimate of the clock-like tree. Find values for this double difference in log likelihood and make a histogram of them, and then see where your real data is on that. I won't say any more about it, but say that there is this simulation method related to parametric bootstraps for getting a more relevant distribution for the distribution in a log likelihood test, which, remember, usually is not of topology but of parameters and things. But it turns out there is a way of using those kinds of simulation empirical simulation distributions of things. And so that's all I'm going to say about bootstraps. Where we are headed is to Brownian motion models of change of things like gene frequencies and quantitative characters, and how you estimate trees on them.
And there's some interesting work there. We're going to have to whiz through it in less than a lecture, and that's going to be not really great, because, but there's lots of material in the book. But I want to get now to talking about continuous characters, some models in population and quantitative genetics that relate to them, and work on things like comparative methods that will be of interest with those kinds of characters. So we should let you out of here. I think there are people waiting to come in, and